Registration is now open for our 2017 National Conference, No Other Gospel, Reformation 500 and Beyond. Find out more at thegospelcoalition.org/2017. This is the Gospel Coalition podcast, where we seek to renew the contemporary church in the ancient gospel of Jesus Christ. I'm your host, Colin Hansen.
I'm thankful to be joined today by Ross Douthat, columnist for the New York Times. Ross, thanks for sitting down and talking with me.
Thank you for having me.
Ross, we first talked in 2012 in the release of your book, Bad Religion, How We Became a Nation of Heretics. What'd you change if you wrote that book today?
Well, it was wildly optimistic. That's the main thing. No, it's interesting. I would say that book was written in part in an attempt to sort of move the debate over the state of Christianity and religion in America beyond certain binaries that I felt were sort of left over from the 60s and 70s, of, on the one hand, sort of religion versus atheism, and also sort of conservative Christianity versus liberal Christianity. And basically, I was trying to sort of complicate things a little more and saying, look, there's this huge part of the American religious landscape that isn't secular, isn't traditionally religious, doesn't fit into sort of left versus right paradigms. And I used the term heresy because I thought it made sense, you know, that these were forms of religion, everything from Oprah Winfrey to Joel Osteen, basically, that were sort of Christian-ish, still partaking of Christian ideas without being fully connected to the Christian past. So that was the argument then. And I guess what I'd change is just that I think some of those binaries have turned out to be more powerful than maybe I was giving them credit for 4 or 5 years ago. I think secularization, like actual secularization, is possibly become a more powerful force in American life, certainly than was true 10 or 15 years ago. And also we've seen a kind of fascinating springtime for an explicitly theologically liberal Christianity that I think had seemed to be sort of a 1970s antique just a little while ago. And I would say, especially in the age of Pope Francis, in my own Catholic Church, you've had a kind of renaissance for liberal theological ideas that had fallen on hard times. So those are, I suppose, sort of the biggest changes, that the binaries have sort of reasserted themselves from secular liberalism's pressure on conservative Christianity in the form of some of the stuff the Obama White House has been doing, to the return of 1970s style debates in my own church.
Is the greater threat to the church, especially in the West, come from the inside or the outside?
That's a hard question. I would say that I guess I'll stand by the argument I made in the book and say I think ultimately the biggest threat is from this sort of half in, half out zone, and that to the extent that if you can imagine a world where Christianity was sort of fully replaced in some sense, I don't think it would be replaced by a hard secularism. I think a hard secularism is a very thin, potentially weak thing that becomes very vulnerable very quickly, as I think we're actually seeing in parts of Europe right now. And I also don't think it would necessarily be replaced by a sort of explicitly liberalized theological perspective. I think it would be replaced by a more sort of generalized, syncretistic, Gnostic kind of spirituality of the kind that is in certain ways already the dominant form of religious expression and belief in America. I guess I'll double down on my 2012 thesis there and say even with sort of liberal versus conservative debates resurgent, even with sort of secularism pressing anew at religious institutions, if you're talking over a long-term time horizon, or you're talking about the life of sort of the average American with religious impulses and yearnings, the rival of Christianity is this sort of trending towards post-Christian but not yet post-Christian Gnostic spirituality, really, that doesn't fit either the sort of inside or outside paradigm precisely because it's sort of in between. it's appealing precisely because it still has a foot in traditional Christianity, while also having a foot very far outside it.
Many of us read your columns regularly in the New York Times, where you deal with a lot of these issues. Why does the New York Times let a social conservative have a column?
Well, I actually have obtained incriminating photographs of most of the...
I figured it must have been.
No, I mean, the Times, I think, you know, I'm obviously a loyal employee, so I would say this, but I think to their credit, they see the op-ed page as a place that to have a diversity of voices and perspectives, and I think...
But a social conservative.
Well, there are many social conservatives, even now, in America and the West, and they... And I think it's... If I were running a newspaper that was seen as having sort of a liberal readership and perhaps a liberal slant, I would want a sort of social conservative there to mix things up. And that's, I guess, what I see as my role. And I think they see that as my role, too. And I've been there a little while now, so hopefully they've been reasonably happy with the experiment.
Does it pay off for them in readership?
Oh, I have no idea.
Well, that's part of the media challenge, because there's always competition in media. But you're trying to make money, but you're also driven in many cases by a certain ideology or a certain worldview, a certain perspective, and they're not always working together. So in many cases, you'd think more media outlets would look out on the country and conclude similarly to what Fox News did years ago when they broke up the cable monopoly and more or less said, why are you taking up this position? Well, because conservatives watch television as well, but more newspapers have not actually gone in that direction where you think they might have. So I wondered what the incentives look like there for a newspaper that is committed to a very specific social perspective, which is in conflict with yours.
Yeah, I mean, my sense is that the Times itself has a sort of old-fashioned, and by old-fashioned I mean, you know, from the pre-internet age perspective on what it's doing in terms of its editorial choices, insofar as it tries to keep them very segmented from, you know, walled off from sort of the business side. And it tries not to make editorial choices with commercial imperatives foremost in mind. Now, you could argue that is maybe a mistake, and that there is sort of opportunities in ideological diversity and so on, but I think the media landscape, for a while my assumption was that we were headed towards a kind of more British newspaper market in the US, which we sort of have. I mean, you know, the Wall Street Journal is sort of the newspaper for, you know, the business class with a free market op-ed editorial page, and The New York Times is sort of the paper for the intelligentsia, the sort of professional class with a more liberal op-ed page. And then the Washington Post and Politico are sort of in competition to be the paper of the political class. But there isn't quite the same, we still haven't really ever developed the equivalent of sort of, this is, you know, here's the right-wing paper, here's the left-wing paper, here's the center-left paper, and so on, in the way that Britain really has for a long time. And I think in certain ways it's all being just overtaken by algorithms and social media and so on in a way that makes that kind of sort of thinking about the space a newspaper is in almost antiquated. But again, I mean, we're having this conversation on the day when Facebook had a meeting with conservatives in order to talk about whether its feed was slanted against conservative news sites, which it almost certainly was. But that we're sort of into that landscape in certain ways, in ways that I think trump the sort of audience choices of specific institutions sometimes.
You're accustomed to writing fairly controversial things for that space, so we're talking about there. But what specifically is the most controversial view of yours among your colleagues?
Well, I mean, I think sort of social conservatism writ large is obviously something that sets me apart probably from the average, not just person at the New York Times, but person in professional media in Washington, D.C. and New York. I mean, I would say it's sort of, I think, probably pretty obvious, but there is a distinction, I think, that's felt between an issue like abortion and an issue like same-sex marriage, where being opposed to recognizing same-sex marriages is, you know, seen as sort of not more controversial, but just sort of more impossible to understand how anyone could hold that view, I would say. Whereas with abortion, you have there's a certain liberal respect for the pro-life position in the quote-unquote liberal media, and I don't think that has held for a while on same-sex marriage. So that would, I guess, be a distinction. I find it easier to write, and this isn't about my colleagues, this would be more about my audience, but I find it easier to write a pro-life column, whereas when I would write about same-sex marriage skeptically, I would be much more defensive and guarded in the way that I wrote about it, probably, which again reflects just the reality that I don't think a lot of my readers sort of have a basic, you know, have a sense of sort of where the social conservative position is coming from on that issue.
Well, you had both of those issues juxtaposed against each other last summer. So you had the Supreme Court decision and the Planned Parenthood undercover videos. Right. Did you see those distinctions playing out as you addressed both topics?
Yeah, I mean, I think with the Planned Parenthood videos, there's much more of a desire to look away in a very literal sense when you're dealing with videos. But in terms of, you know, if you're thinking about how sort of more liberal journalists cover those stories, you know, there was the desire to say, well, the videos, you know, they were tricked, the whole idea that they were sort of dishonestly and deceptively edited and so on. There was a palpable desire, I think, not to have the lived reality, or not lived reality, but deathly reality of abortion sort of front and center in the coverage and in people's minds. Whereas, with the Supreme Court decision, there's no defensiveness, just sort of a straightforward celebration. I think it's very hard to celebrate abortion in the way that people are very comfortable, I think, for understandable reasons, celebrating same-sex marriage.
Is there a discernible path that somebody might follow to emulate your career example?
I don't think that there's a path in the sense of sort of try to get this job and then that job and so on. I would say that, you know, I was sort of lucky in a way in that I had done sort of conservative journalism in college and I'd interned for National Review over the summer before I graduated, but then I didn't get a job in conservative media. I applied to a lot of places and they weren't hiring, or they hired somebody else. And I did get a job as a researcher for The Atlantic, which is a sort of, you know, a magazine with a mostly center-left staff, but with a sort of a goal of sort of even-handedness, or at least having a diversity of views.
But clearly not
a publication that leaned hard to the right. So that was sort of where I got my start, and it meant that I was always, you know, very comfortable writing for an audience that didn't necessarily share my views. So to the extent that, you know, if you're talking to a conservative or a religious conservative, an Orthodox Christian, and so on, about sort of making their way in media, and if they want to write for readers who don't agree with them, my advice is to try and figure out how to get started on that early, because it's, well, both professionally, you sort of get tracked into specific areas of the media, and if you work in conservative media, you're more likely to stay in conservative media and so on. So sort of where you start out matters, but it also just matters in terms of the way you write and the way that you engage with readers and your understanding of what people who don't agree with you think and how to reach them. Now, I'm not sure that I ever actually reach anybody, but I at least give the appearance of trying. Hopefully.
Well, you're trying to persuade people, but I don't see a lot of people trying to persuade in columns anymore. I don't know if they used to more often than not, but there seems to be more assertion. I think it corresponds to some of what we're seeing in politics. Less of an effort to try to persuade people who disagree with you, and more of an effort to simply rally people and then to demonize.
Yeah,
opponents.
I don't know how new that is, to be honest. I mean, I think that, you know, column writing has always been often, you know, a chance to sort of rally your readers into feeling good about a particular set of views. And, you know, I mean, there are times when, to be honest, I would like to do more of that, right? Like, I would like to write the kind of columns that some of my, you know, fellow conservative writers write for conservative audiences, or some of my fellow liberal columnists write for more liberal readers, where you can sort of assume that your readership is with you at a 70% level, at least. Whereas I tend to assume about a 30% level, depending on the column.
I want to talk about probably, I would say, your most haunting column. You can disagree with me about that. Other readers might disagree. But more than 2 years ago, before the Supreme Court decision that we just talked about, legalizing same-sex marriage across the country, you wrote about the terms of our surrender. And you wrote, "All that's left is the timing of the final victory, and for the defeated to find out what settlement the victors will impose." What does that settlement look like now, 2 years later, and how do you think it will ultimately conclude?
I would say, has it been 2 years? Wow. I mean, my overall sense has been that sort of activists on those issues have pushed a little harder, a little faster than I would have expected 5 years ago. Maybe 2 years ago I was starting to expect it, but sort of the complete rout of religious conservatives on, you know, sort of the protections for florists and bakers and so on, wedding professionals. If you had said 4 years ago even that, same-sex marriage will be universal, but there will be some controversy about, whether florists can be compelled by law and under point of fines to participate in same-sex nuptials, I think most people would have said, well, that's an area where probably, you know, they'll carve out some exemptions and so on. And instead, that territory was just very, very quickly overrun. And the fact that, you know, we've sort of shifted tracks in certain ways to transgender issues, but there too, I think, the sort of basically every form of attempted pushback from religious conservatives, every attempt to sort of carve out sort of zones of protection and so on, ends up looking like a huge tactical mistake, because it sort of focuses the attention of media, activists, celebrities, and so on. And, you know, for instance, I'm not sure we would have gotten the Obama White House's recent guidance to public schools on bathrooms if there hadn't been this big controversy over North Carolina's law. Maybe we would have. But it seems like there's this cycle where sort of religious conservatives try to sort of push back a little bit here on a religious liberty issue, or try and push back on, you know, regulations surrounding transgender rights, and that push is just very swiftly met with a very hard push in the opposite direction. So that's sort of where we are, where sort of the specific battles are shifting a little bit haphazardly, but the push is very strong. And I honestly don't know how far it goes. I think that what you'll see are, you know, a lot of religious institutions will find ways to sort of make a kind of peace with the new reality. And, in the case of Catholic institutions, for instance, there'll be sort of different accommodations reached to cover same-sex domestic partners at many, many Catholic schools, I would think. And I guess the big unanswered question is, to what extent will that sort of general shift be satisfactory, and to what extent will that mean that sort of the holdouts are kind of isolated but also sort of left alone? Or to what extent will be there this push to say, well, you know, if we can get Notre Dame to do this, then we should get Baylor to do that, and if we can get Baylor to do that, we should get Wheaton to do this, and so on. And that's where you start getting into territory of accreditation and tax-exempt status debates. And there have already been,
So it was a Supreme Court decision.
Right. Mm-hmm. But that's sort of the open question, I think. How quickly and to what extent does it go to those issues? But I do think, you know, there's just going to be a lot of institutions looking for ways to sort of accommodate themselves. You're not going to have a kind of united front of religious institution resistance, I would guess.
Core conviction of social politics for at least decades has assumed the threat of backlash. It seems that in the Obama administration, we've seen the end of the consequences of backlash.
Yes.
Politically.
So far, I would say that's true. Now, again, you assume that, and then at some point, you know, at some point you hit that.
You're still
point.
Holding on.
Well, no, I mean, if the Obama White House tomorrow announced that it was unilaterally recognizing plural marriage all across the U.S., I think there would probably be some backlash.
Yeah,
right.
Okay.
I mean,
I'm just saying
you can come up with scenarios, and the reality is that, you know, there isn't backlash until there is, right? I mean, if you go back to the period from 1960 through the late 70s, there was an awful lot of social change that happened in a very swift amount of time, and the backlash was sort of fragmented. It often took a while to get going. It was scoffed at and so on. But then at a certain point, the push had gone far, a long way, and some of the costs began to be apparent, and the backlash gathered steam, and you got the sort of cultural stalemate that we then ended up spending a generation living through. So at some point that will happen again, but yeah, we haven't hit that point at all.
I guess many on the left might see Donald Trump as that backlash.
Yeah.
What's significant is that
he's not
pushing back on these issues, sexual issues.
Right. I mean, I think there is a connection there with, you know, the idea of Trump being politically incorrect is sort of connected to people who would say, well, it's ridiculous to call Caitlyn Jenner a woman, right? I mean, I think you can draw, even though Trump isn't interested in social issues, I think you can draw a connection between a certain kind of grumpy, isn't it ridiculous what, you know, these liberal college kids are up to with their 17 genders thing and the appeal of Donald Trump. So yeah, in that sense, Trump could be a forerunner of a more comprehensive backlash potentially, but his campaign has been focused on a different set of cultural concerns than the ones religious conservatives are most interested in.
What could conservative Christians have done differently to avoid this outcome?
I am not at all sure. I would say, you know, I can tell a story in which what you might call, frankly, a more Christian response to, among other things, the AIDS epidemic, and sort of gay culture in an earlier era in American history would have made a difference in terms of creating context for sort of common ground, compromise, deal making, and so on. And I think that story is true insofar as I think Christians should have responded differently. I'm not completely sure it would have ended up in a totally different place. I think there is sort of an unfolding logic of liberal individualism that takes you in certain directions, whether or not, you know, you can sort of redirect it and slow it in certain ways. But it goes where it wants to go in certain ways, more so than where and how you can turn it. So in terms of differences, I mean, I think, you know, conservative Christians could have been better at politics in certain ways. Had they been better at politics, potentially the Supreme Court would have a slightly different composition,
several bad appointments.
Right, several bad appointments, and then, mm-hmm. and then sort of things, you know, the logic still unfolds, but there are more checkpoints and more
protections
carved out.
You might not get Kennedy's opinions.
Right, you wouldn't have Kennedy. You would have same-sex marriage advancing via state courts and, you know, eventually via legislatures and so on, but you would have much more of a patchwork quilt of same-sex marriage, same on religious liberty and so on. So there are sort of specific tactical things, but I'm not sure what the sort of macro level answer is. I think, you know, most Western societies have ended up in a place where traditional Christianity is a lot weaker than it used to be, and ours took a little longer to get there, but it's not surprising that that's where we're headed.
So is there anything we can do now to avoid that outcome? You alluded earlier to the seeming inability to find a tactical retreat, a safe terrain to defend.
Yeah, I mean, I think that you have to build institutions with the assumption that the state will be at best indifferent to your institutions and potentially more hostile than it's been. That's what you have to do, basically. So if you're a Christian college, if you're starting a Christian college, if you're running a Christian college, you want to think about where your funding streams are coming from and make the assumption that, that funding streams that are connected to the government might be compromised at some point. If you're running any kind of religious entity, you want to sort of establish religious parameters, which is something that, for instance, Catholic schools are basically trying to do in order to sort of protect themselves against lawsuits, to sort of establish that you are a religious institution and therefore, you deserve First Amendment protections for your hiring decisions and so on. So, this is good news, right? In a way, religious institutions are being called to be more authentically religious, more autonomous and independent of the culture and the government. And in the long run, that isn't a bad thing to be. It's just that the transition to getting there is going to be very, very bumpy.
You just have to come up with hundreds of millions of dollars.
Well, right. Well, you have to build slowly. I mean, it's also, we're talking in sort of pessimistic terms, but it's important not to be sort of overly apocalyptic either, right? I mean, the same Supreme Court that sort of mandated same-sex marriage around the country also ruled 9-0 in Hosanna-Tabor, one of the last big religious liberty cases. Like, there is still fairly robust religious liberty jurisprudence. The First Amendment, we're having arguments about where it applies to hospitals and schools and so on, but scenarios where sort of freedom of worship is compromised seem very unlikely to me. Scenarios where pastors are forced to officiate at weddings
right.
seem very unlikely
yeah.
to me. So the practical reality is that conservative religious groups are going to be under a lot more cultural pressure and ultimately a lot more financial pressure than they've been accustomed to in the past. And that's going to be really hard to deal with. But it's not the same as being actively persecuted, which strikes me as very, very unlikely.
How did
Although, we can have this conversation again in 5 years.
And, well, it does seem that on some of these issues, the politics don't make sense. So forcing pastors to perform weddings against their conscience does not seem politically likely
right.
because the political coalitions cross the parties.
Yes.
Because you'd be forcing a lot of ethnic minority pastors to do that who are theologically conservative. Whereas the Christian college situation seems it could be addressed potentially from the Supreme Court angle, but it also could be addressed simply whether in an Obama administration or a subsequent administration through the same way a lot of other things have been decided through redefining older legislation.
Right.
Title IX, things like that.
Right. And that's where, you can imagine the scenario where the evangelical school or the Catholic college is itself being, it's sort of ordered to change its housing policies, its bathroom policies.
Hiring
and so
policies.
On, and hiring policies.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, that seems quite imaginable.
How did religious liberty pick up scare quotes?
Because it's seen as a form of discrimination comparable to denying black people service at segregated lunch camps.
Was that inevitable? I mean, how did that happen?
It happened because there is the country sort of internalized for good reasons the arguments made about the necessity of civil rights protections for historically disfavored minorities, right? That, it's okay to refuse service to someone who isn't wearing shoes or isn't wearing a shirt. It's not okay to refuse service to somebody who's African American, right? And that model, I think, has sort of been very effectively rhetorically extended to encompass gays, lesbians, now transgender, and so on. And the counter argument is ends up either sounding like you're, you know, sort of you're defending segregated lunch counters, right? You know, business, or it's sort of a it amounts to, you know, it sort of gets bogged down in arguments about the nature of homosexuality. You know, can you know to what extent are things chosen or unchosen, and so on. But basically, I think the culture has accepted at least a partial analogy between race and sexual identity. And therefore, the rules that we came up with around race, that we came up with in order to dismantle, you know, structures of oppression, are seen as sort of very natural to extend to sexual identity.
They're imported and imputed.
Right.
Ross, you wrote a book about how the Republican Party can win the working class and save the American dream. So you saw the rise of Trump coming.
We're actually reissuing that book. It's
Be
called How Donald Trump Can Win the Working Class and Make America Putin's Russia. And it's going to be a big bestseller in the Trump era.
He'll
buy it in bulk. And this was a book, you know, we were talking about a book I wrote 4 years ago, but this was a book I wrote, I guess, 8 or 9 years ago now, co-wrote with my friend Raihan Salam. And the argument basically was that the Republican Party had, for various reasons, including social conservatism, but other reasons as well, acquired a large middle class, lower middle class, and working class constituency that was not obviously well served by Republican policies on taxes, the economy, and so on, and that was going to grow, we thought, increasingly restive if the party didn't sort of develop a new economic agenda. And that didn't really happen in 2010 and 2012. Instead, we got the Tea Party, which sort of channeled some of those anxieties, but was manifested more as a kind of strict, limited government, cut the deficits, balance the budget kind of movement. But with Trump, we have a much crazier and more bizarre version of, I guess, what I sort of expected. I just didn't expect it to happen this way. But Trump has clearly tapped into a sense among a lot of Republican voters that the sort of conservative movement agenda on a range of issues, not just economic policy, but foreign policy and social issues too, is just sort of irrelevant to their lives. And Trump has basically said, well, I'm just campaigning as a nationalist. I'm going to, you know, renegotiate trade deals and bring jobs back and build a wall so the immigrants can't take your jobs. And I'll stop fighting dumb foreign wars. And, you know, I'll appoint pro-life judges, but I think Planned Parenthood's pretty okay, and so on. And that combination has turned out to have a large, large appeal. I think the Trumpian message still is not a sort of majority perspective in the Republican Party. I mean, I think that, you know, he did win the nomination with a plurality, and a plurality that stayed stuck around 35% or 40% of the vote for a long time. But clearly the message, one message, there are many messages, God help us, of the rise of Donald Trump, is that a lot of Republican voters just don't really think that sort of the talking points of 1980 have any relevance to their lives anymore. And Trump saw that opening and exploited it to the hilt.
So do you see him more than as an unmasking figure to reveal what was already there, a disenchantment with that 1980 economic message, a lack of fidelity to even some social conservative principles, more so than merely a product of peculiar electoral circumstances?
Oh, I think that he's the unmasker for a reason, right? It takes a figure who doesn't come out of the party system, doesn't have, you know, this sort of network of pre-existing commitments and ideological formation and sort of consultants whispering in his ear, telling him what to say. Trump had none of those things and was just sort of winging it from day one. And that, combined with his celebrity and the fact that he was, you know, he's not completely funding his own campaign. He takes donations, but he doesn't have, you know, now he does because he's a general election candidate,
right.
But as a primary candidate, he wasn't trying, you know, to sort of be the candidate of, you know, sort of the New York Republican donor class, for instance. And so he had a sort of liberty to just sort of try things out, say whatever he felt like. And of course, he also delights in contradicting himself and, you know, lies the way most of us eat breakfast. So he has sort of the liberty of a demagogue that most politicians don't have. So he has a lot of things going for him that enabled him to sort of reveal this underlying truth in a way that the typical politician would not have been able to, I think.
This question would be somewhat related, given Trump's peculiar marriage history. But how did marriage more broadly in this country become a middle class to upper class aspirational value? Like, what happens to our society when the poorer classes across ethnicities largely abandon marriage?
I mean, you know, one thing that happens is that people become more likely to vote for Donald Trump. I mean, that's, yeah. that's you know,
sure.
One of the interesting dynamics is that of the Trump victory is that he did worst in the most sort of socially cohesive parts of America, basically the upper Midwest, the Mormon West, and he did best in areas of sort of social dysfunction and disarray. He did very well with sort of unchurched evangelicals, basically, which is a population that tends to have more divorces, more out-of-wedlock births, and so on.
Spousal abuse.
Mm-hmm. And he did well in the kind of trending post-Catholic, post-industrial Midwest. So in certain ways, Trump, the support of sort of downscale white voters for Trump is kind of an object lesson in the actual dangers of social disarray, basically. That social disarray does make people more susceptible to demagogic appeals. So that's sort of a political upshot. But, you know, the sort of deeper reality is just that, you know, we have a society in which basic human goods that were taken for granted as sort of crossing lines of class and race and culture 50 or 60 years ago are now, aspirational. And they're aspirations that people still have. The working class still wants to get married, still has sort of and holds up an ideal of marriage as sort of the best way to have a family and raise kids and so on. But for various reasons, they aren't able to sort of fulfill the model of sex, romance, and marriage that we've sort of instantiated and that the upper middle class is pretty successfully following.
It seems to be a pretty dramatic shift that now the wealthier you are, the more likely you are to be married and to go to church.
It is. Yeah, it upends a lot of conservative images, right?
Absolutely.
Of this sort of idea from the 70s and 80s that was really true then, that sort of there was this fundamental sort of working class backbone to social conservatism and that, you know, culture war battles pitted, you know, sort of blue collar Americans with middle American values against these sort of effete and decadent elites. Now, I mean, part of that is just that we have an upper class that's extremely large now, right? I mean, if you just look at the super rich, I mean, you were talking about Trump's checkered marital history. I'm skeptical that I don't have the divorce statistics for the richest 0.01% ready to hand, but my guess would be that the absolute top, you know, of the American economic ladder are not leading lives of perfect bourgeois stability. But in what you might call the mass upper class, the top 5, 10, 15, 20%, there's this sort of, this kind of post-sexual revolution restabilization where you have a kind of, you know, Amish-style rumspringa in college in your early 20s, and then you get married and settle down and you don't get divorced. If you get divorced, you get divorced late in life. You don't get divorced when you have kids, because that's bad for the kids, and everybody understands that. And it's bad for your position in what is a very competitive meritocratic landscape. The sort of, I mean, my colleague David Brooks, in a fonder portrayed, and I would offer called this bourgeois bohemianism, right? This sort of combination of bourgeois and bohemian values. And I think it really has, it's stuck and it's worked for a well-educated, well-to-do segment of American society.
Well, the Republican Party establishment, especially during last President Bush's administration, pushed for a path to citizenship for undocumented immigrants. You were not particularly enthusiastic about those plans. And I'm wondering, does Trump's rise vindicate some of your cautions in that regard? Or does it simply set up a full-scale amnesty under President Clinton?
Both. Probably both. I would say that, yeah, the most likely end game for Trump's sort of ride on the immigration issue is a more sweeping amnesty than Hillary Clinton elected president, and then a more sweeping executive amnesty, or in the, you know, depending on what happens with the Senate and the House, something passed via legislation. My skepticism is less about a path to citizenship per se. I think that ultimately, you know, I don't think plans to deport 12 million people are reasonable or humane. I think ultimately you would expect over the long term that you'd want mechanisms for integrating immigrants who've lived here a long time into American society. My skepticism is more specifically about sort of future flows of immigration. And I'm skeptical about America's ability to successfully assimilate low-skilled immigrants, precisely given some of the issues that we've just been talking about, the sort of social disarray at the bottom of the economic spectrum. And what you see with sort of, you know, it's hard to, in order to track intergenerational mobility, you need sort of generations of data, and obviously the immigrants arriving today are going to have very different trajectories for their kids and grandkids than, say, a Mexican immigrant who arrived in 1950. So it's hard to make perfect comparisons, but we do see a fairly frequent pattern where, you know, the first generation of immigrants do very well, and then there's a sort of segmentation where some of them assimilate upward, but then there's a lot of downward assimilation, basically, to lower class and underclass norms and mores. And you see this, you know, the steady rise in the Hispanic out-of-wedlock birth rate, for instance, where, you know, out-of-wedlock birth rates in Mexico are very different from out-of-wedlock birth rates for immigrants here and for their children. And that, yeah, I think that what that suggests is that the American economy and American society are not doing particularly well by people who come here without sort of more than, you know, a sixth grade education or an eighth grade education, or particularly not doing well by their descendants. And so it makes sense to have an immigration policy that keeps that in mind and that basically doesn't eliminate low-skilled immigration, but sort of tips the balance towards higher-skilled immigration a little bit more. And that's not all of the comprehensive reforms have basically combined a path to citizenship with a marked increase in immigration overall and low-skilled immigration in particular. So that's what I'm skeptical about. The effect of I don't think Trump is tapping into a deeply considered theoretical perspective on low-skilled immigration. Ultimately, he's tapping into people's fears of cultural change, in which immigration plays a role. And I think that has been a big part of his appeal, and it's something that Republican politicians need to sort of learn from and recognize that they can't just sort of endlessly push immigration reforms in defiance of their own basis wishes, but the political upshot is likely to be something, you know,
the opposite of what Trump claims to want.
Right. What he really wants, who knows?
Your first book was about your alma mater, Harvard, on the education of the ruling class. So, describe the rise of safe spaces and restrictive speech codes.
So this is actually quite interesting to me. Now we're going back even further, yeah. Right? But so I went to college. I went to college, you know, between 1998 and 2002, and you know, then as now, there were hardly any conservatives on elite campuses. There were certainly no conservatives, you know, in significant positions of administrative leadership. There were very few on the faculty. So most of campus debate, most of campus political debate at an Ivy League school featured sort of liberals versus the left, with conservatives like me as sort of taking pot shots and sort of as total outsiders. And what's changed in the last 10 or 15 years is the balance of power, basically. When I went to school, you know, there were campus protest movements. There was, you know, a movement for the living wage at Harvard when I was there, where they occupied the president's building and so on. But it wasn't an incredibly powerful force on campus. And a more sort of centrist liberalism was very much ascendant. And there was a sense, you know, it was the late 1990s. Alan Greenspan was in charge of the economy, all was right with the world. There was a sense that sort of capitalism had figured things out. And that, you know, and it was it was a sort of ebb period for political correctness, for that style of activism that had been obviously big in the 80s and early 90s, and now we're in a high tide, and this sort of centrist liberals are basically on the run and sort of surrendering on campus after campus.
The Hillary Clinton supporters. Right, being featured in major media as persecuted minorities.
Right, although that's probably overstates the case a little bit. Never underestimate the self-dramatizing power of being in college. But still, yeah, it's a situation where, in certain ways, I think the campus left has exploited, you know, the moral and spiritual vacuum that centrist liberalism has, or certainly had when I was on campus. That, you know, say what you will about the tenets of political correctness, as the Big Lebowski, well, not the Big Lebowski, but Walter Sobchak would say, but at least it's an ethos, right? And the problem for sort of centrist liberalism, the liberalism of the administrative part of the university, is that it just seems, you know, it seems sort of impersonal, bottom line focused. I mean, you know, something like the campus rape debates, right? I do not support the kind of strangely left-wing yet neo-Victorian attempts to regulate exactly what manner of bedroom moves can be undertaken and so on. It seems like you're setting up a sort of crazed late feminist police state. But at the same time, those activists are not wrong that the administration on major college campuses basically turns a blind eye to a campus culture that encourages not sort of outright rape per se, but very unhappy sexual situations for young women, and that these schools, you know, they sort of talk a good game about, you know, we're a family and we're all watching out for each other, but if you go to the administrators and say, you know, I've been raped, they don't want to deal with it because they don't have a mechanism to deal with it. So these elite schools are very rich, bottom line focused, hyper-competitive organizations that sort of posture as holistic, friendly places. And I think the gap between that posture and the reality is something that the left has skillfully and understandably attacked and exploited.
You talk often about decadence.
Yes.
What is a decadent culture, and what difference does it make for religious authorities to understand what it means to live in a decadent culture?
So my pet, you know, decadence is it's a very flexible term, right? But the way I've tried to use it is to mean basically stagnation and repetition at a very high degree of technological and economic sophistication. So a decadent society is not one that's in steep decline with the barbarians about to sweep across the borders. And it's not one that's just sort of has loose morals or something. Like the Roaring Twenties were not decadent because they were booming, they were growing, they were expanding, they were changing. There was cultural ferment, and yes, that cultural ferment included, you know, flappers and gin, but that's just sort of debauchery. It's not actual decadence. Real decadence comes in when you're stuck, when you're basically doing the same things over and over again, having the same debates over and over again, when your economy is not collapsing, you know, the Great Depression wasn't decadent, but not expanding rapidly. Technological progress isn't happening as fast as people expect it to. So I think that, you know, whatever happens in the next 10 or 15 years, I think the United States and Western society have been effectively decadent for the last, 25 to 40 years.
So is decadent the last stage before collapse?
Not necessarily.
Okay.
Because, one, collapse can take a very long time to come, right? So it can be the last stage, but it could also last for hundreds of years.
Sure.
I mean, you know, if you sort of take it on a civilizational timescale, Imperial China was arguably decadent for hundreds of years before sort of the Western powers came in and kicked the door down. You know, it was stagnant. It was sort of, you know, wasn't technologically developing, wasn't expanding, wasn't exploring, and yet it persisted, right? So you can persist, but then also a period of decadence could end with a new burst of ferment or a political revolution or something that doesn't necessarily, or a religious revival that doesn't necessarily lead to swift decline. It could lead to sort of rebirth and growth. So saying that we're decadent is more optimistic than saying we're in steep decline on the one hand, but it also includes the pessimistic possibility that you could just stay stuck for hundreds of years.
Well, let me go back. You talked about abortion being the most controversial view that you hold. Or now, actually, you said gay marriage was the most controversial view, but abortion seems plenty controversial.
Abortion is plenty controversial, but it's something where people on the other side at least understand why you think what you think.
Yeah. Well, where does the pro-life movement go under a President Clinton or a President Trump?
Under President Trump, you essentially hope for the best with Supreme Court appointments, and I don't think that hope is strong enough to justify supporting Donald Trump.
But why not?
In the camp.
If it's life and death issue.
Because there are, well, we were just talking about decadence and decline and collapse, and one answer is that there are more than one life or death issue. And I don't mean this in the terms that sort of the left sometimes uses, where they say, well, you know, abortion is a life and death issue, but, you know, welfare policy can also be a life and death issue. I don't think that comparison works. But global statesmanship is closer.
War is a life and death issue.
War is explicitly a life and death issue. And to some extent, so is domestic tranquility. I mean, one thing that I worry about with the Trump era, basically, is a return of actual political violence to the U.S., which is something that we haven't had in this country to a large extent. You know, we've had isolated horrors like the Oklahoma City bombing, but we've had very few assassinations. We've had very little organized domestic terrorism and so on. And Trump's willingness to sort of wink at violence and also to sort of radicalize his opponents potentially strikes me as a frightening possibility. And so does the basic reality that, you know, that he has a temperament that seems likely to provoke constitutional crises. He has a temperament and a lack of experience that seems likely to provoke various kinds of crises overseas. And I understand someone who would take the opposite view and would say, look, you know, the life issue is the life issue. There's no other issue like it. And even if it's only a chance that Trump appoints a justice, you know, and throw in protections for religious liberty and so on, it's a chance you have to take. I just think, you know, at a certain point, there has to be a basic bar for fitness to be president, right? You wouldn't say Charles Manson promises to appoint pro-life justices. You still can't vote for him for president, right? I mean, I might write him in this election cycle. but you take my point, right?
Yeah.
So I just think if you had gone back a year ago before any of this happened and just said to conservative Christians, does Donald Trump pass the fitness test? Most serious conservative Christians would have said no. And I think, and I don't think anything that he's said or done has changed
that
opposite direction,
right?
Mm-hmm. So it's just hard for me to see how people could or should get there with him.
You're seriously concerned about the future of Europe. Can the continent, with its amnesia toward its religious history, resist the seemingly inevitable reconfiguration brought upon by mass immigration?
I have no idea. I was more optimistic about Europe 5 years ago, I would say. I feel like what we've seen in the last 5 years, and especially the last 2 years, is a kind of striking acceleration of what seemed like sort of deep structural trends that Europe had a lot of time to manage, right? So yes, Europe's birth rate was low. Yes, it had sort of immigrant populations that were going to be challenging to assimilate, but those populations weren't that large. Europe was very wealthy. Its institutions were basically stable, so you were going to have threats of domestic terrorism and problems of sort of radicalized Muslim ghettos, but it was all manageable. And it may still be manageable, but the political collapse in North Africa and the Middle East, and joined to sort of Europe's response up to and including Angela Merkel's decision to just admit a million refugees, seems to me to sort of just hit the fast forward button on a lot of trends. And beneath that fast forward button is this sort of this just huge demographic gulf separating Europe's trajectory from not just Middle East and North Africa, but sub-Saharan Africa. In this is in a way for sort of conservatives who are worried about a Muslim future for Europe, this might, this could be argued is actually good news, that sort of the migrations that could really reshape Europe over the next 50 years may increasingly be Christian migrations or animist migrations. But basically, yeah, Europe is sort of seems like it's in a deeply unstable demographic position relative to the much more unstable and poorer countries around it that are increasingly, whose populations increasingly can use modern technology to be mobile in a way that
refugees... They don't have to assimilate.
They don't have to assimilate, but it's also just much easier to get to Europe,
right,
and get there and have the connections to people who are already there in a smartphone age than it was before. And I think, if you want to be optimistic, you would say this is, going to be transformative, but Europe will come through it and it will, take in hundreds of millions of North African, Middle Eastern, and ultimately sub-Saharan African migrants, and they will figure out how to deal with it. But the fact that just this level of migration has produced a basically sort of crypto-fascist backlash all over the continent suggests that, in fact, that the politics of backlash will be very strong on the continent, that the return of nationalism will be very strong, and you'll have this dynamic where you have increasingly nationalistic countries that don't have the birth rates to sustain themselves and are sort of facing migrant populations that are very difficult to assimilate but have every incentive to try and come. I don't know what will happen, but it doesn't seem like an optimal scenario. I think you'll have a great deal of sort of European forms of Putinism, and you see versions of this already in Eastern Europe, to some extent in France, I'm concerned about the future of Europe.
Staying in Europe and talking about somebody who's been a staunch advocate of accepting and welcoming immigrants, Pope Francis, you've written a lot about him, but I want to focus on one specific element of your writing about him. You're writing about how the fascination with him reveals that possibly America is not nearly so secular as we might imagine. Some of the pushback you got, though, is that this fascination with the celebrity of Pope Francis does not seem to correspond to a particular adherence to his authority when it comes especially to the sexual issues where he holds to a traditional view and where his fans don't seem to really care in many cases. So I'm wondering, how do any religious leaders sort of teach authority in this anti-authority age?
Well, I think, at the risk of adding to my reputation as a critic of my own Pope, I think that Francis, in certain ways, has missed opportunities, that his ability to sort of essentially recreate Christian iconography in his own person, these images of him with, you know, kissing a disfigured man and sort of in the crowds, reaching out to the poor and so on, are powerful enough to, at least temporarily, sort of overwhelm typical Western skepticism about leaders of the Catholic Church, let's say. And I think that, you know, if, but I think that the theory, Francis's theory, is that works best if it's also combined with a kind of deliberate downplaying of the issues where there's the strongest tension. So that's sort of been his strategic theory, not to sort of change church teaching on most of those issues, though divorce has been a particular flashpoint, but to essentially sort of downplay on the one hand and then sort of play up the Christian message on issues of sort of poverty and outreach and so on. And I mean, I think that, you know, that ideally that you would be able to sort of play them up equally in certain ways. Now, if he did, you know, when he just did something sort of slightly haphazard, like meeting with Kim Davis, right, when he was here, the sort of horror among many of his admirers, right, was swift, and the desire to say this had all been a terrible mistake arranged, yeah, by, you know, was...
Somebody was fired.
It was very potent, and maybe that's... I just think it would be interesting to sort of rerun the Francis pontificate with exactly the same, you know, rhetoric on the environment, on migrants, on the poor, the same sort of gestures of humility and so on, but with a louder message on sexual ethics, and see what happened. I don't know exactly.
A little bit more like John Paul II if he were today?
Maybe, but John Paul was, I mean, Francis has been more, his desire to be sort of a pope for the poor, as he put it, has been more a part of sort of the visual style of his papacy than it was, you know, he and John Paul do have a lot in common, but that sort of stripping down of the papal office's trappings, that sort of going out among, you know, among the poor, among the disfigured, among the refugees and so on, that's been stronger than what John Paul did. And the choice of, you know, writing an encyclical letter on the environment and so on.
I want to close with a couple personal questions. You write a lot about ominous trends. We've been talking about a lot of ominous trends here. But as a parent, are you concerned? Do you look back on your own upbringing and see anything that your parents did especially well that you want to carry through? I mean, how does this hit you personally?
I mean, with my kids, it's weird. We're talking about all these sort of deep structural trends, and we haven't talked that much about technology. And what's interesting as a parent is that I think I spend more time worrying about technology than I do about trends in American Christianity or something. I mean, you know, I think it is, my sense of things is that it's very hard, you know, based on my own family experience and many other families, your children are people, and they will sort of take a religious path that, I don't know, I guess I sort of have a clear sense of my, you know, I'm being a little bit inarticulate, but for whatever reason, I tend to think of their religious path as being in God's hands in some sense, and that the world is going to be probably fairly hostile to the form of religious faith that I'm trying to impart to them, and there's only so much I can impart it to them, and there's so much I can do, but I can't protect them forever, and so, you know, we'll see what happens, right? And some of this probably comes from being someone, I wasn't protected. I had a weird childhood where my parents were sort of on a religious journey that took us through all kinds of forms of Pentecostalism, evangelicalism, and then we ended up Catholic. But all the while, I was going to very secular educational institutions and never felt like I was, you know, sort of in a protective religious cocoon in any way. So that inclines me probably to, you know, not worry too much about sort of creating a religious cocoon. I worry more about protecting my kids from sort of the social effects of computers and iPhones and social media. And I'm honestly just I hadn't even maybe thought about this fully before you asked the question. I'm not sure why that seems more within my control than sort of their long-run religious experience. But it seems to me that sort of when I think about my own childhood versus my adulthood and the life that I lead, you know, with my phone and so on, there's, I guess I'm sort of most nostalgic for a world before the internet as a kid, even though I like the internet and use it obsessively. And so that is the thing that I guess I feel like my sort of strange, slightly embattled religious childhood is something that I can imagine just sort of reproducing itself kind of naturally in this in this landscape.
But not the technology,
because the technology is it's there. The change is more complete. But there are sort of deeper spiritual issues there where it's sort of like, you know, it's one thing to imagine your child deciding that their dad was wrong about, you know, same-sex marriage or, you know, Catholic orthodoxy or something and ending up in a different religious place. It's another to imagine your child sort of entering into a kind of, you know, world of virtual reality in that's sort of one further step removed from the possibility of contact with the divine. Does that make sense? I don't know.
Yeah, I think I can. One of the scariest dystopian futures I imagine comes from Ready Player One, a book, I don't know if you're familiar with that one, but where the moral of the story is more or less in this indulgence of virtual reality and sort of 80s gamer culture and things like that, the moral of the story is, this is terrible. Because it's removing us from our very humanity, and the humanity that we can only realize in contact with one another, which is an essential component to our contact to the divine.
Yeah, there was that picture that went viral online of, you know, a conference forever, you know, sort of people trying out Oculus Rift or one of these VR headsets. So it was it was Mark Zuckerberg walking down an auditorium with all these people with headsets on. And that image, when I think about my kids' future, that image frightens me a lot more than the fact that Facebook's news feed might be biased against religious conservatives, I guess. I guess that's sort of what I'm trying to get at.
I would agree with you on that one. So last question, if you had a few minutes with an assembly of religious leaders eager to know how they could stand against the world, but crucially for the world, in love for the world, what would your message be?
My message would be, I've been very pessimistic, but trying to mix pessimism and optimism together. On the one hand, you want to, you know, the pessimistic side of the argument would be that religious communities need to build their resilience, right? They need to be resilient against trends that are likely to undercut and be hostile to them. And, in order to preach the gospel effectively, you have to have some kind of institutional foundation, and those foundations need to be sort of dug deeper than they've been recently. And this is, you know, gets into sort of Rod Dreher's Benedict option kind of thing. And, you know, I mean, Rod and I have some differences, but I think his fundamental point is right, that you have to build institutions on the assumption that you're operating in a hostile landscape going forward. But at the same time, while you're doing that, you also want to recognize something that I've sort of alluded to before, which is the, you know, there's just a deep weakness to hard secularism. And that a lot of the time, even in this landscape that's sort of hostile to Orthodox Christianity in whatever form, it's not it's, you know, you're not dealing with a world of Richard Dawkinses and Sam Harris's. I mean, even Sam Harris, you know, his books are actually shot through with religious and spiritual yearnings that he just wants to make clear are not about Western monotheism, that crude mistake. They're about sort of the more scientifically minded Eastern mysticisms. But like, but seriously, that's the reality of the human condition. It's that even in a quote-unquote secular context, people are still reaching for God, for ultimate purposes, for religious and mystical experiences. And that creates a receptiveness to a Christian message, even in a landscape that's generally hostile, that, you know, should provide a reason for optimism and sort of a reason for a basic confidence that you can, in fact, still do missionary work, even or especially in a secular age.
Well, Ross, thank you for your writing, and thank you for taking the time to talk with the Gospel Coalition today.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Gospel Coalition podcast. For more Gospel-centered resources, visit thegospelcoalition.org.